So good evening. Just want to say a few words about the meditation practice itself before I get started on the talk. That during these Tuesday nights, we don't typically teach the meditation, at least very thoroughly. That's why we have four beginning classes each year. And we have one coming up on October 1st. So I'll be leading that one. So if you haven't had those instructions or you like a refresher, you're encourage and attend that so you understand the practice of meditation itself. And this class, these Tuesday night classes, take that assumption we know how to meditate and then how do we bring it into our lives. So tonight, we're going to explore wise speech. So wise speech is one of the most critical things in our own daily lives to bring mindfulness to bring awareness to. Because how much harm do we cause through our speech, through our communication? How much harm is caused to us through harsh speech, from false speech? And so it's one of the most critical areas for us to really explore and deepen around with our practice. And when we say the word wise speech or right speech, that tells us we're within the Eightfold Path. So this year, Tweri and I have been exploring the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path as an anchor for the year's teaching. Now, if we look at it, so we can't look at speech just in isolation. We have to see how it relates to the whole Four Noble Truths. So the Four Noble Truths, you know, briefly, it's the origination, that there is suffering or dukkha, there's origination of that dukkha, there's a cessation of that dukkha, and there's the path to ending of that dukkha. So that awareness that we've explored the first part of the year, the first few months, comes into the Eightfold Path through wise view. It's like this orientation of how do we approach our practice, how do we approach the Dharma, and how do we actually approach our lives from that understanding of really in the deep roots of what causes our suffering. Not the superficial things, but the very deep aspects. What is those causes? And the more we understand that, we can start to bring it to play into our lives. Right? So wise view orients us toward these Four Noble Truths. Then wise intention, the second fold of the path, helps bring that in, like our intention hooks up into our actions. Right? Because we always have some intention going on. There's always some intent behind our actions. Often it's intention, perhaps out of pain, to try to avoid pain, to try to find some kind of pleasure. But if we orient toward the noble truths, that becomes the orientation. That becomes the place intention hooks that up into our actions. And so then we come to wise speech. And how do we hook this up into our understanding of our the Dharma, of the practice, into how we speak, how we use our words. Now, a theme that I'm going to be using for these next couple months as we explore wise speech this month, wise action next month, is this movement from an outside authority into our own internal authority. Why do we act in a way that's based in non-harm, in ethics? So moving from this outside authority, it's like the, you know, tablets carved by God sort of a thing. You know, this, you know, commandments, this big overreaching thing that says, you shalt not do this. Or our parents or our boss or someone else saying, do this, don't do that. So often we learn it in that way. But we have to go from that external authority into our own internal authority, to our own understanding of why do we act in this way. You know, I'm more curious, how do we act when no one is watching? When no one will know if we did something or didn't do something? You know, that's a really interesting test of what comes up. You know, if I take that extra cookie or if I tell a fib or do something and no one will ever know that, you know, where am I on that line of going into that ethics or having that come from a different place? We also have to consider our internal environment, because we can all be very ethical, but under tremendous pressure, as we're forcing ourselves to be good kids, good boys and girls, repressing and overcoming our urges. So the practice goes beyond that kind of repression into a much deeper understanding. Even more interesting to me than this external and internal authority, you know, how do we go from that transition? The movement from willpower to natural state. Instead of the willpower, okay, I'm not going to tell this lie, I'm not going to steal, I'm not going to harm. From an act of will to it becomes our natural default, our natural state. So it's no longer a choice of whether we're ethical or not. It just naturally we can't go against being ethical. And what is that transformation in our hearts and minds that happens? So it's not from willpower or self-control, but there's this deep transformation that happens that we just can't harm another person. We can't speak something which is not true. It's said that at a level of awakening, it becomes impossible for someone to break the precepts, to cause harm, when their understanding, the realization is so deep, they can't go into a harmful place. So we'll explore this movement throughout these 2 months as a theme I'll come back to. And we'll circle back to this at the end of the talk here. So wise speech. And in speech, I mean all forms of communication. You know, texting, emailing, blogging, whatever it might be. Any kind of communication, any kind of external communication is under this umbrella of speech. Now classically, there's 4 main areas of wise speech that we'll explore. Abstaining from false speech, abstaining from slanderous speech, abstaining from harsh speech, and abstaining from idle chatter. Okay, so we'll take a little time to explore each of these and see how we can get a grip on those. So this first one, abstaining from false speech. So these are often voiced in the negative, you know, what we're refraining from, right? But there's also the whole positive aspect of speaking from a truthful place. So I'm going to read some of these descriptions from the sutta. I've taken these from the book The Noble Eightfold Path by Bhikkhu Bodhi. It's a very very nice small book that covers the Eightfold Path in much detail, and I very appreciate that piece. So the Buddha said, herein someone avoids false speech and abstains from it. She speaks the truth, is devoted to truth, reliable, worthy of confidence, not a deceiver of people. Being in a meeting or amongst people or in the midst of her relatives or in a society or in the king's court and called upon and asked as a witness to tell what she knows, she answers, if she knows nothing, I know nothing. And if she knows, she answers, I know. If she has seen nothing, she answers, I have seen nothing. And if she has seen, she answers, I have seen. Thus, she never knowingly speaks a lie, either for the sake of her own advantage or for the sake of another person's advantage or for the sake of any advantage whatsoever. So false speech. So this description shows both the harmful parts, the negative parts, but also the wholesome parts, the positive aspects of speaking from a true place. Now when we think about when we have the intent to tell a lie, to speak something that's not true, if you look underneath that impulse, there's often a deeper root that's coming up, a deeper movement, often from greed, a sense of scarcity, of want, a sense of hatred, of trying to lash out, to hurt, or from delusion, from a sense of confusion, of not being clear about how things are. So these different roots have different ways of coming through with this false speech. Now this particular one, a false speech, for those familiar with the 5 precepts, this is one of the lists. If not, not speaking that which is not true. It's said that someone who is a bodhisattva, someone who's on this long path to awakening, full awakening, and really waiting till everyone else awakens with them, they can break the other precepts in this long pathway except for this one, about false speech. And why is that? The sense of false speech is the path practice is really aligned with understanding how things actually are. Actually touching into the bedrock of how life is. Right? And so if we deny that, if we go against that, it's really contrary to the very practice. And that sense of alignment with how things are. So speaking something that's false, we're denying that. One of the things about this practice, if you learn how to meditate, you're really learning the skill of how to pay attention, how to be present with your own experience, to notice how the body is reacting, is responding, the thoughts that arise and pass away, the different emotions. And then you start to notice the deeper intents behind those actions, often revealed by the body's tension, by those subtle thoughts, those subtle beliefs, those subtle stances that we take. So if we practice for any length of time, we start to realize we can't get away with anything from ourselves. We know ourselves so deeply that every motivation is shown to us. And if we're denying that and hiding that, we feel that tension, we feel that pressure. So moving from the sense of external authority, like don't tell a lie, to the sense of wanting to be aligned with the truth, to really know how things are. Now, should we just speak everything that's true, though? We could often talk about these different gateways of speech. So first gateway, is something true before I speak it? Is it actually factual? Is it true? Now this itself is quite a high bar, because so often we say something is true, but often starts with the phrase, you are, right? You are such a da-da-da-da. Right? It's really our opinion. It's our ideas of what that other person is, or even ourselves, how we take ourselves to be. There's a parable from the Buddhist time that you have this elephant, and you have these five blind people to come explore this elephant. The first person comes to the tusk and feels that aspect. Another one feels the ears. Another one feels the tail. Another one feels the trunk. Another one feels the leg. And so they put them in a room and ask, so what is this elephant? Can you describe it? And so one says, it's like a spear. Another one says, no, it's not. It's like a leaf. Another one says, no, it's like a trunk. And so they get in this big argument, all because they have their direct experience of this elephant, but it's limited. It's limited. And they took that small experience and formed it into this opinion, into this idea. Right? So we do this very often, unfortunately. We take a little bit of data and we make this whole worldview around it. And we argue and we fight others who are contrary to that. So holding this sense of, is it true, very lightly. Is this just my understanding? Is this my perception? What is truly true? Like your body. Can you describe how your body is? We have a sense, okay, this is my body. But as you close your eyes and go into that experience of the body, the outline perhaps vanishes. The distinction starts to soften. It's filled with lots of texture, lots of pressures and releasing and various sensations are constantly in flux. There's nothing that's solid when we actually look closely. So what is true is this first gateway to hold that. My sense of this is this. This is how my experience is. The second gateway is the timing. Actually, the second gateway is it beneficial? Is it beneficial? So before I say something that's true, is it actually beneficial to be said for this person to hear this? Now, from the Buddhist perspective, beneficial means it leads to your liberation. It leads away from suffering. Period. It's a high bar. And so reflecting on it, is this leading to someone's benefit, deepest benefit? And then finally, the timing. Is there a place where that person is receptive, is able to hear this truth that is beneficial? So this first aspect, abstaining from false speech. Now the next one is abstaining from slanderous speech. Slanderous. Again, from the Buddha's words, he avoids slanderous speech and abstains from it. What he has heard here, he does not repeat there, so as not to cause dissension there. And what he has heard there, he does not repeat here, so as not to cause dissension here. Thus he unites those who are divided, and those who are united he encourages. Concord gladdens him. He delights and rejoices in concord, and it is concord that he spreads by his words. That sense of slanderous, when we intentionally try to spread a rumor, spread some fact about someone in a way to harm them, to undercut them, to hurt their reputation. So in the Buddhist time and to this day, that intentionality of it, that carries what's called a deeper karmic load. Karmic load. So we don't often talk about karma, but I'm going to touch upon that. So karma literally means action. It means action. Okay, this intention to act. Now that action carries a certain weight or certain momentum that has a fruition in the future. So often we really misuse it in our culture. It's like, that's my karma. Is actually, should be, that's my karmic result. That's my karmic fruit, right? This sense of karma. So how this moment shows up for us is in some ways already been set by our past history, by our past actions. So how we responded to a certain a situation, a certain experience, how we dealt with that, how we reacted to it, how reactive we were, how calm we were. This sets a certain momentum that then predisposes us to react a certain way, to even more to predispose to actually perceive things in a certain way based on that past history. Even in cosmology of Buddha, the Buddhist tradition, it goes back beyond this lifetime. That there's this momentum that makes it very hard to distinguish what actions cause this seed to grow. Now when we're intentional about something, we want to harm someone, that carries a higher weight to it, a deep. It's like being premeditated. You know, if you just get angry and you hurt someone or kill someone, it's a lesser crime than if I plan it out. An intentionality behind it. And you can feel that, you know, in your own heart. When you really are hurting so deeply that you want to hurt someone, that you meditate, how can I really hurt that person? How can I spread this rumor? You know, there's a way that you're indulging and feeding that painful aspect. It may feel like that's a release to it, that's a way to make it feel better, but it really deepens the pain. There's also the kind of the unconscious quality when we start to gossip about someone else. Like, have you heard about so-and-so, that thing that happened, that terrible thing? You know, it's almost this unconscious quality of spreading rumor. So how do we work with these two patterns? I think the suggestion not to do it isn't often helpful. Right? Because this is part of human nature, is to perhaps want to speak something that's untrue, to want to lash out with our words. Okay, so instead of, when you feel that impulse to lash out, come into the body. Come into the body as a refuge And notice, what is the body's experience of this? This is a really important technique and approach and method to learn. That's why we emphasize the body so much in our practice. Feeling the breath, feeling the body sitting. So become more and more sensitive to the body's life, the body's experience. That becomes this touch point when we have this impulse to act in a harmful way. We feel that. We can feel the resonance in the body. Going to the thoughts around it, the beliefs around it, the emotions around it, we're going into like this maze. We become lost, entangled, confused. It's very hard to think our way through this. Come into our body, there's a clarity. There's a clarity that the body holds. Right? The caveat is, and the disclaimer is, you have to be willing to feel the pain of the body. Right? So when we are acting out, we're mad at somebody, we want to slander them. Going into the words, going to the thoughts, distracts us from the real hurt. So we have to develop this tolerance and this capacity to meet that hurt, to feel it in the body. And once you start to do it, you realize that's the fastest way through it. It's the fastest way through it. It leads to the least amount of suffering. Paradoxically, you have to go into that suffering. You know, there's this tenderness, feeling that pain of the heart. There's an urge to lash out, to act out. But if I can learn to feel that, to open to that, to hear the deeper meanings of that, then I'm really attending to the pain directly, not to the impulse to lash, to hurt. Now, if we really take this aspect of right speech, we start to develop this sense of friendship. People start to trust us, that you're a trustworthy person, that I can say something to you and I know it won't come back to hurt me, to haunt me, that you hold something as a precious gift in confidence and with care. And so we know people like that, that we can tell them things and we know that they hold that with sensitivity, with care. And we know other people that we share, it will quickly spread. So abstaining from slanderous speech. Now the third one is abstaining from harsh speech. Harsh speech. What the Buddha said about that is that she avoids harsh language and abstains from it. She speaks such words as are gentle, soothing to the ear, loving, such words as go to the heart, and are courteous, friendly, and agreeable to many. So this sense of softness of speech, a sense of gentleness of speech. When I first read that, there's this question, well, what happens when I have to say something difficult to someone? When I have to confront someone on their behavior? You know, can that come from a kindness of heart? Can I touch into that kindness of heart, not come from the sense of pain, of harshness, of trying to harm? Surely that intention to harm, often it's quickly reactive, it's impulsive, that we lash out often from that. Now learning to, again, tend to that tenderness of the heart, that sense of, okay, where am I feeling defensive? Where am I feeling attacked? Where am I feeling I have to justify, I have to explain? Touching into that, again in the body, allows you to start to shift from being reactive to being responsive. When we're reactive, we create lots of collateral damage. We create hurt feelings that we have to often go through and mend. And the consequence of not mending that can be tremendous. I mean, remember my father-in-law, so he had a brother, that there was some argument that they had, and they decided to stop speaking to each other. And that became a habit. For 20 or 30 years, they did not speak to each other. And then one day, the younger brother had a heart attack and was unable and died, went into a coma and then died, without them ever touching, that original conflict, never connecting with who they are in the present moment. So this harsh speech, speech can be so painful, so harmful. So if there's one thing that you take into your life, you know, bring speech into it. Bring wise speech into our lives. So instead of feeling that pain and reacting from it, coming into that tenderness of heart as the homework approaches, when we touch into it, we can have the possibility of seeing, is there a more wise way to attend to it, to attend to that pain. It's abstaining from harsh speech. Then the final category is abstaining from idle chatter. This is one of the more difficult ones for us as lay people. So he avoids idle chatter and abstains from it. He speaks at the right time in accordance with facts, speaks what is useful, speaks of the Dhamma and of the discipline. His speech is like a treasure, uttered at the right moment, accompanied by reason, moderate and full of sense. Full of sense. So the sense of idle chatter, I think we have to really look at our intention behind that chatter, right? Because part of connecting with people is just you chit-chat, you talk about your life, you talk about what's going on. You don't have to talk about, you know, what's your experience of the Third Noble Truth? That's the only thing we talk about, and we don't talk about anything else, right? We'll be very, very strange, very lonely people, I think. So noticing that intention, you know, often you want to connect with someone. So that sense of wanting to connect, to have that sense of understanding, tell me about your kids, tell me about what your hobbies are. That's perfectly fine. You know, you're connecting, you're focusing on that connection. And as you're doing that, really listen very deeply. And then as you share yourself, you know, how can I share in a way that's heartfelt? You know, maybe working on sharing maybe not just the superficial, but something that's really tender, something that's very important to myself. Now, back to that intention, sometimes we can also be trying to just not be bored, not to be quiet, not to be silent. You know, we're uncomfortable with that silence between words. So connecting with that underlying discomfort. Now, if we expand this idle chatter to include cell phones and surfing and Instagram and Snapchat, and how much of our time we're sitting waiting for the bus, waiting for something, do we pull out our phones, right? Notice the impulse that precedes that pulling out. So you got to slow it down. For a while, you're going to be like, you already got the phone out and you're already doing it before you realize what's happened. So when that happens, put the phone away for a second and just notice the body. Notice that, okay, I'm bored. I need something to stimulate, something more interesting, something to connect with. All right? Learning to connect with that in the body and opening to that starts to transform those kind of dull moments into a place of aliveness. Otherwise, we're just addicted to the phone, and the phone is designed to keep us engaged again and again. So the practice isn't about, you know, you should do this or shouldn't do that. It's simply knowing yourself, knowing what's in that heart, and making a choice. Okay, what's something that, you know, I do need a distraction, I need to decompress. Or I'm really trying to avoid this deeper pain that I really should have a conversation with a real person around. So idle chatter. So these four aspects of wise speech, abstaining from false speech, abstaining from slander, harsh speech, abstaining from idle chatter. Kind of the common thing that we do with this is learning to attend to our internal hurt that often generates this pain, this action of false speech, of slanderous speech, harsh speech. and it'll encourage us to take it beyond just what we speak to our internal dialogue, to our self-speech, self-talk, how we talk to ourselves. You know, is there any sense of harshness of speech inside? Any sense of that sense of saying, okay, I'm such a bad person? Or just the idle chatter that we just kind of daydream and keep going on and on. So we start to really make headway in this. We have to include that also. And how much do we allow ourselves just to go into that harshness versus really attending to the pain that's driving that? And as we do that, we start to notice an internal stillness arises, both in our external speech and our internal speech, as we learn to really pay attention to where our thoughts go, to where our words go. There starts to be an internal quiet. And this is, the genius of the Eightfold Path, that it's both a way of a path itself, like as a way to deepen in, but also as a way to confirm the path. So our wisdom shows us, okay, our understanding of our body, of our experience, our ability to be present in the moment allows us to see, am I speaking harshly? Am I speaking untruthfully? And then practicing it starts to quiet ourselves. We become more and more quiet, which allows us to have even deeper seeing. So circling back to that beginning statement about how do we move from this sense of willpower, the sense of, okay, I'm just not going to speak something that's false, I'm not going to speak harsh, to more of a natural default. What is that movement about? To understand that, we have to go to some of the deepest roots of our lives, the deepest roots of our actions. You know, is our actions coming from this fundamental sense of confusion, greed, and hatred? Or is it coming from wisdom and compassion? And so there's kind of a tipping point of which is predominant in our lives. In certain conditions, we may be more inclined one way or the other. And the practice starts to purify that, starts to make our practice, our lives, really more directed through wisdom and compassion, instead of our greed, instead of our hatred, instead of our pain. And even deeper than that is a sense of separation, a sense of duality, that there's me and the other. There's you and me, there's what I like and don't like, there's that sense of separation. There's a sense of me looking out, me experiencing this. If there's a sense of separation, there's always going to be a sense of insufficiency, of lack, of incompleteness. If there's separation, then I'm always trying to bring things back to completion. From that energy, if that's really what's driving us, then of course it makes sense to speak harshly, to be false, to try to arrange things to get us back to connected. It doesn't work, but it's what makes sense. And yet, if we come from a place of deep wisdom and compassion, and then we see that there's not a sense of separation, there's not a sense of self and other, that's really just this one thing, this one experience that has different manifestations. If we orient to the background that connects everything, then there's naturally a completeness, there's naturally a wholeness. And in that wholeness, there's nothing to obtain. There's nothing to change. And in that, then there's no impulse to be unethical. There's no impulse to reach out and harm, to steal, to lie. So the full expression of this is the fullest level of awakening, of enlightenment. But not to say that we can't have taste of this and understanding of this all the way along. We start to see, there's aspects we start to become, have taste of this. Often we don't notice it because it doesn't catch our attention. We're so geared to find, okay, what do I want? What's the lack? What do I have to fix? What do I have to get more of, get less of? Where am I at fault? Where are you at fault? I mean, these are all the roots for these, that creates these unethical actions, the falsehoods, the slanderous speech. But at the same time, if you're just listening to the sound of the train, when you're just feeling the breath, when you're just feeling that simple sensation go through the body, and there's no friction with that, there's no trying to change that, in that moment we're getting very close to the non-separation, the union. And if you can drop the sense of me observing, me watching, so there's just a melding of that, a merging of that, then there's no movement. There's no place to go. There's peace. There's peace. So we just sit quietly for a moment or two and let those words settle where they will. As we sit, just connecting with this body, connecting with the quality of the heart, being willing to connect with the heart and the body before speaking. Aligns us naturally with wise speech. Being not willing to speak from a closed heart, from another hurt, but to attend to this. Simply being present. So thank you for your kind attention. So before we open to any comments or questions about wise speech, I'd like to talk about the homework and the practice and reflection. So choosing some of your challenging patterns around wise speech. So this list of abstaining from false speech, slanderous speech, harsh speech, and idle chatter. You know, pick one, pick two, that you find that there's kind of an edge for you, that you find yourself again and again kind of telling those little white lies, or speaking, jumping and being harsh, or that sense of gossiping to undercut someone. So one of those patterns, you're going to make that a cue. So whenever that arises, instead of indulging and going into that pattern, you want to come into the body, touch into the body, feeling what is the body revealing, what's the body knowing in this impulse. Connect with the underlying tenderness that may be with that. There often will be a sense of hurt, a sense of pain, of insufficiency, of being overlooked. Whatever it might be, touch into that. And see, is speaking from that really the right course? Or is there a better way to attend to that, better way to meet that? And you find that your speech starts to naturally change. You start to become more aligned with your understanding. And you find that people respond to you in a different way. And notice how this practice starts to change this internal stillness. If we're always talking from a harmful way, it creates a lot of noise. A lot of static in the system, right? Starting to quiet that down, we naturally become quieter internally, which allows us a deeper seeing, and so it starts to have a really nice positive feedback loop. And then for extra credit, apply this all to your internal dialogue. Apply it to how your self-talk, the self-talk of harshness, of criticism. And so next week we'll have a chance to explore this in some small groups and kind of really flesh it out. It's really helpful to come to these discussions, these small groups, because you get to voice your understanding and you get to hear other people's experience of how they're working with that. So it's often a very synergistic process. So we have a chance for any questions or comments. And can we turn the light on so I can see? Yes, Susan.
I have a reoccurring conversation with a friend, a Dharma friend, and I notice I heard this phrase a long time ago. It was like, don't talk about anybody else unless they're in, you know, with you.
Right.
So I have a conversation with this person, and it goes to another person, and I don't know what to do, so I go, yeah, I go along with it rather than, what do I do with this? I feel like, well, I know what I'm feeling, but if I said something direct, I don't think that's the, I don't know, but I'd be like, okay, can we just talk about us?
Yeah, so that's interesting.
It's a little thing, but it is
yeah,
an
quandary,
expression
yeah.
of, it's not necessarily harmful, but it is, I feel there's a glitch there, a catch.
Yes, yeah, nice. So the question is around a Dharma friend and how often the conversation turns to another person who's not present. And the sense of feeling that glitch and that sense of that doesn't quite feel right, but how do you work with that? Because feeling in your body, you can feel that, but the person still wants to talk about this other person. Is that, yeah. Yeah, Joseph Goldstein took a practice on to not speak about anyone who's not present. And he realized there wasn't really much to say after that. Because so much of our talk is like, oh, have you heard about so-and-so? And a lot of it's, catching up and connecting, and it's, more or less harmless. But it can easily start to shift, can it? To like, do you hear what they did, how they messed that up? Or, that kind of, it can really easily shift into that. And the question is, well, how do you work with another person? So if it's really a Dharma friend, then talk about the Dharma and say, how about let's experiment? Let's say for the next 20 minutes, we won't talk about anybody but who's you and I. Our own experience, and then we can talk about someone else. So kind of having that sense of agreement can be very helpful. And say, well, what's it like to do that? And what's it like to not do that? So kind of calling attention to it in a playful way, in an investigative way, is going to be more received than, we really shouldn't be talking about anybody else. That doesn't get received so well. So that's one thing that comes to mind. If you're talking with someone who who's not a Dharma practitioner who may not have that perspective, sometimes you can just be honest. It doesn't feel good to talk about that person without them here. Just that can be a simple way to do it or redirect the conversation. Yeah, it's a tough one. It's a very common one. Yeah. So the other person has a need to talk about someone else.
Yeah.
And so can you address that need? Just with ourselves, it's like we have this impulse to speak in a harmful way or an idle way or something like that. If we feel what's behind that impulse, we feel often the tenderness around that, and we learn to connect with that and attend to that directly, it actually works much better, because this is just like a Band-Aid. There's still the cut just keeps bleeding. But and so you can also, as you do that to yourselves, you start to be able to sense that with other person. It's like, oh wow, you know, you really seem like you're really jealous or something like that, or you long for that person, or you want more connection or something like that. So, you know, calling attention to that, just as you would to yourself. And try to do it in an open way so they can, you know, adjust your statement. Yeah, it's relationship is a dance, right? It's like we step on our toes, each other's toes, and we bump at each other, and sometimes we're in perfect harmony, and then, you know, the music changes, and the other person keeps dancing a different beat, and so it's like that willingness to always be paying attention, to always be listening and seeing how can I can move with this. You know, and also attending to ourselves. Sometimes we just need to take a break from that relationship or that dialogue. Yeah, it's not a lot of easy answers. It's just how do we attend to ourselves? The deeper we know ourselves, the more options we have. Yes.
So, because in my life I've gotten a lot of feedback professionally that I need to speak up more and mm-hmm. talk more.
Yes.
Being just a quiet guy, you know, I always feel this pressure to, you know, formulate words and throw stuff out there. Sometimes when I'm not even sure, you know, exactly how it's going to come to you.
Mm, yeah. Sure. The wise speech and then the impulse the suggestions to professionally to speak more, going different ways.
Being very careful about speech versus
yeah.
being a little bit more creative or
yeah.
let's see what happens.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, that's a nice nice question. So to paraphrase it for the recording and those who may have trouble hearing, just professionally having a feedback that it's important to speak up more, you know, being a more introverted or shy person, not the natural tendency. So you need to kind of show up more and speak more, be more spontaneous and put yourself out there, be more brave. And that seems to be contrary to the wise speech, which is kind of like you're being much more collected and careful and sensitive before you speak. It seems like there's contrary to each other. And how do you work with that? Is that yeah, basically it. Yeah, it's really, I like this question because from a dharmic standpoint, these kind of questions of, you know, like, how should I work with a relationship? How should I work with my work and these kind of issues? The dharma is not about solving those problems. It's really focused on at the fundamental problem, which is what's a root of suffering. You know, what causes suffering? And the end of that suffering. So I'm starting big and I'll come back. And so the one really helpful way to frame that is this belief in myself, in the sense of self, how I form myself into me. And so for some of us, that self is really gregarious and outgoing and extroverted and likes to speak and actually has a tough time not speaking. You know, like I'm always having to put my fill up the space with words. Others of us, our self is more shy and more introverted and more quiet, right? So wherever our self tends to form, whatever that natural polarity is, the most learning is to go opposite of that, okay, from a dharmic standpoint. Because what we want to do is challenge the solidity of the sense of self. If I stay within my comfort zone of what I naturally like to do, I'm maintaining that solidity, maintaining the root of my suffering. Okay? But I start to explore that, I start to challenge that, I start to shake that up, I start to loosen that. that's directing us. That's the whole point of the Four Noble Truths, is to see what causes our suffering and that deep level of selfhooding, selfing, of creating the self. So that starts to loosen up, that starts to soften by going opposite of that. So someone who speaks a lot, actually holding back and being quiet and listening, it's like that's the work, that's the hard edge for that person. Well, someone like yourself and like me, you know, I don't like to speak in front of people. And so I have to really not believe the voice of that construction of self to be able to get up and speak or to ask a question. And so that's really the edge of the work. And for myself, that is really, that's integral to wise speech, because it's really proving, it's really working with the root of suffering. And it's a much more simple way to think about it. Speech is wise if it's undercutting the root of your suffering. And so for yourself, I would kind of loosen up. Because if you're at all like me, there's a sense of kind of over-analyzing and saying, okay, I've got to ask just the right question in a skillful way, and by the time I get that formulated, you know, it's the conversation's changed, or, okay, it's time for ride share, and we get around to it. And so it's actually much better just get up there and just, you know, have the courage to just sputter around and stumble and then get it out there. Because that's undercutting that sense of self, right? And so I would emphasize less of the trying to get it perfect. And just notice, just touch in briefly, okay, see, let me feel my heart. Is my heart closed? And is it hurt? You know, especially if it's hurt or angry or fearful, to notice how I speak from that place. That's really the key with the wise speech. Because if I start to speak, you know, not a sense of like, okay, I'm feeling scared now, I'm feeling hurt, that's being very sensitive and vulnerable. But saying that, you know, I just hate when you ask that kind of a question. That's, you know, I'm just, you know, I'm putting it on another person. You know, so that energy is what you have to attend to. But otherwise, just, you know, put yourself out there. Yeah, and that's good that you asked the second question. So does that help? Yeah, so the professional stuff, it's nice because it does correlate to the path. If you reorient in that way, that actually getting up and speaking in front of people starts to loosen that belief in self, and it helps your career. But the career, that's from the Dharma standpoint, that's a secondary benefit. Yes. Good.
Yeah. I have been struggling for about a year with a friend who sends me maybe 10, 15 texts, like just long
Oh boy.
And emails. And when I don't respond, phone calls. I was on vacation for the last 10 days and I came back to like text after text.
Wow.
And I just can't do it anymore, but I feel like I'm not being compassionate or loving if I'm like, I need a break.
Yeah, so that's a heartfelt question. So just again, to repeat it, or paraphrase. So a friendship, a person tends to send a lot of long texts and long emails and seems to escalate to phone calls. If you're not responsive enough and it's been ongoing for a year and that person's sounds very needy and lonely and asking you to fix that. And at the same time you're feeling kind of this kind of double bind that you want to be compassionate for this person, but you're also at your your rope's in. You can't do this anymore. Yeah. And so, yeah, these kind of questions. It's like always coming back into that sense of the most tender part of it is, you know, this is too much. I can't handle this anymore. Right? Then there's the should. I should be compassionate, which is denying that sense that this is too much. So, you know, first spending some time to really know yourself, okay, know that sense of this is too much of a burden, this is too intrusive, this is more than I can take care of. So you're really honoring that in yourself. Okay, so when you touch into that, and then the sense of being needing to be compassionate, I mean, it's like you have to always include yourself with that compassion. And especially with the dynamic that's been set up, you've been used to putting her first and then yourself, right? So now weigh yourself first. Put yourself first in the line. What's right for you first, right? And then that starts to, you just kind of have to kind of push the boundaries out again. It's kind of, there's a kind of a boundary imbalance, right? She's overreaching, overextending. The compassion part, though, is that she really desires connection. And so does she live in the area? So maybe you could say something like, you know, I really want to connect with you, but I need to do it, you know, more discreet times. And say, let's set up a phone date. We'll talk at this time, you know, I'll give you an hour and you can just talk about whatever you want. And then at that, I have to go do something else. And just start to draw some boundaries around your own time and your own well-being. And so that way you'll actually be able to show up much more for her. Because it could be that she's feeling that sense of you're not wanting to meet with her and she just doesn't know any how just to put more and more on you, right? But if you can actually meet her and say, okay, that she feels met, then you can have more of that space. But it's like you have to have the courage to talk about that dynamic and find a way for you both to have that, your needs met. You know, so you honor each other. You know, that's because the compassion can't just be one-sided. It's a tough one, and that's where when you feel that sense that this is tough, this is hard to do, that's the time to really kind of, you know, feel that sense of being grounded, being centered, and going that direction. You know, going back to the last question, that starts to loosen that sense of self, the sense of self that is always needing to give and give and give. And never take care of yourself. So for you in this instance, learning to take care of yourself and drawing some boundaries, some compassionate boundaries, helps to disrupt that sense of you. Right? And that disruption brings a much bigger capacity to meet life, to be appropriate with life. Does that help? Okay, good. Thank you for that question. Yes. Okay.
The first one is, so if you partake in false speech, but your intent, your hope is that you're either protecting that person or yourself, you know, through verbal or powerful results.
Mm. Right, right.
And, you know, at some point where it's too much to handle, you're working with someone else, you're talking about that situation or that person, you're hoping to either relieve the feeling you had,
yeah,
or hopefully try to resolve the situation. Is that considered also a false speech? Because you are talking in some ways,
yeah,
later about another person.
Yeah, those are nice questions. So the first one is around, is it okay to speak falsely in order to prevent someone else getting hurt? And the second question is the sense of, if you have a lot of false speech coming at you, can you decompress and have like a talk about that experience with someone else, even though it's technically talking about a third person and you're gossiping or slandering them? Is that true or not? Yes, it's there's a really good questions. And you get a sense of, of this presentation of the false speech, you know, what's why speech, comes from a bit of a monastic perspective, you know, without all the conflict and nuances. I mean, certainly monastics have lots of conflict and difficulty, but they also have a really strong container to work with it. But here we're out kind of in the Wild West, and, you know, everything's coming at us in all kinds of different ways. And how do we adapt? How do we be fluid with that? So the first one about, is it okay to speak something false in order to prevent further harm? That's an interesting one. Is this a particular scenario, or is it more of a... Could you give me a little bit more of a sense of the harm that you're trying to prevent? And well, you can talk about it in a very kind of generic way.
I guess it's, it can be viewed as paternalistic in some ways, if you feel like you're giving the full truth, it might emotionally hurt that person.
Yes.
Or if you're preventing physical harm from being done to that person, you're saying something false to like the family or whatever the case may be, you know, it's not a very positive environment to have. Because I work with a lot of patients, there's a lot of things that I have to manipulate so I don't cause harm to the person.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the gray areas. So I would just kind of, you know, let your heart, you know, touch in with your heart, you know, feel your own sense of reactivity so you feel whatever's in the body, so there's a sense of clarity, and say, okay, whichever path leads to the least amount of harm. You know, so if I have to say a lie here in order to, you know, work with the family dynamics and all these other aspects so that the net result is less harm, then yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, and you know, but you know what you're doing. You realize, okay, I didn't have to do this, but you're consciously doing it. You're doing it consciously. You know, it's a conscious, you know, navigating the complexity of the situation. So I think that's, as long as it's conscious and you're really intending to minimize the harm, I think that's acceptable. That works, and that makes sense. Yeah. And you know, just knowing that you're always holding that sense of creativity, because maybe there's a way of, you don't have to tell the whole truth, you know, with not, again, truth isn't, false speech isn't about not telling, it doesn't mean you have to tell everything that's true, you can just tell a little bit of what's true. You know, you just share a little bit of what's true. You know, remember there's the timing and the beneficialness of that. That's also the aspects. It may be absolutely true, but if it's not beneficial, and if it's not the right timing, then don't say it, or say a little bit of it.
Yeah, I had a patient who had drug for erectile dysfunction. His wife was asking him and me, is this drug supposed to help him with his kidneys? And I just stare at her. They're both my patients. How do I protect one or the other? Because it looks like he's cheating on her.
Yeah, that's really a tough one, isn't it? Yeah, it's I think you just have to feel your way through it, you know, and feel the residue afterwards. If there's a lot of residue, then you know maybe there's a different way of saying it. And there's often going to be a lot of imperfection there. When someone is caught in deceit and lying, it's like the whole thing isn't, I mean, the whole thing kind of needs to fall apart a little bit. And it's not really your job to make it fall apart. Yeah, that's a tough one. That's really a tough one. Yeah, so just, yeah, do the best you can. You know, be as non-harmful as you can. Yeah, it may be, you have to be a trickster. You have to be sneaky sometimes. And that's being skillful. The other question about the kind of decompression or the Gottmans talk about is a stress-relieving conversation. I think, again, the intentionality is important. If you feel like you just, you know, someone really got under your skin and you're really upset about it, It can be helpful to have, you know, someone like your husband or a friend, you can just, or a colleague, you can just vent and don't worry about, you know, being PC or being kind or being gentle. You just lay it out there because you're trying to let it get out of your system. The trick is to notice, do you keep doing that again and again and again? And you start to harden around that belief around that person. Or does it go to letting you feel like you get that energy out of your system and you can have a place of, okay, I can go back to work. I can meet that person again. I can start to understand them in a different way. So ideally it moves that way. If it moves into hardening around that harshness or that, then that's not the right way. You're welcome.